All right, how's everybody doing? Yeah, lots of cool announcements. This is the last panel for the day. After this is a cocktail party with free food and drinks. So I'll remind you again. And we're here to talk about the future of software development. I'm Dan Fernandez, and I have some pretty awesome rock star panelists. I'm actually going to start with Julia on our far side. Julia, why don't you quickly introduce yourself, not just your title, but your first software that you ever shipped and the feature that you're most proud of. So I'm going to ask all of you, so you get to know what their first piece of software is, and I think I know Anders, and the feature you're most proud of.
From the first software that I shipped?
No, it can be from any time, the feature you're most proud of.
So I joined Microsoft in 92, so the first software I shipped in Microsoft was Microsoft Access 1.0.
Woo!
All right.
That's awesome. I'm still running it, so in a container, so it's okay.
And yeah, there's people bought it, you know, on the shelf because it was only $99 at the time, so that was fun. So right now I'm the corporate vice president for Visual Studio and .NET. Most of the awesome technology you see today coming out of my team. So today's a very proud day for me, and thank you so much for coming. I'm thinking about what is the favorite feature. I will tell you one of the hardest features we end up actually working on. Was when we decided to rewrite all of Visual Basic back in 98 to the new .NET and COR runtime and Visual Studio IDE. There was a feature that was really hard to build. It's called Add and Continue. So when we eventually got that one enabled across the entire runtime compiler, debugger, and IDE, then the whole nine yards, that was a very proud moment of achievement from as a development, you know, manager at the time. So
awesome. And people use Add and Continue, love Add and Continue? Yeah, maybe? Yeah. Awesome. Scott?
I'm going to go back before Microsoft. So I joined Microsoft in 2007. But because Anders is here, I want to talk about, I wrote an application called the Wildcat BBS. It was written in Turbo Pascal. And I used to actually drive up and see Anders at Borland back in the day when we built that product.
Oh, that's awesome. You were a BBS nerd.
I was a BBS nerd.
That's great. That's great.
I'm director of program management for the .NET on the server team. So we build all of ASP.NET, Entity Framework, and the tooling that goes around those things. My favorite feature is probably going to be something pretty recent. One of the things that I care about as a web platform is I want to be open and fast and cross-platform. And to me, the .NET Core cross-platform stuff that we're just announcing kind of today in RC is my favorite feature, just because I now can compete with PHP and Node and Ruby and everybody else.
Sweet. Larry?
All right, Larry Rao. I'm from Verizon, actually, so a unique one up here.
We put you in the middle, so yeah. You can't get away.
Yeah, exactly. So my first shipping software was actually working on the Pascal compiler for Tandem computers. So.
See, it all starts with Tandem. <Andrew. laughs>
I'm a director of technology and infrastructure at Verizon, and probably my favorite feature is recently we just implemented a Mesos cluster inside our data centers, and it's really cool to see. We actually publicly showed 50,000 containers being launched in 72 seconds at MesosCon, and that was really cool to see.
Can you say those numbers again, just so like we can hear and make sure all the jaws drop?
Yeah, it was 50,000 containers in 72 seconds.
That's awesome.
And we did this on a 500 node cluster that we exposed, and just for the demo. So it's really cool to see that size of set of machines operating coherently as one unit.
That's amazing. Yep. Rob?
Rob Lefferts, Office Developers and Extensibility. First software at Microsoft was actually SharePoint Portal Server 2001.
Woo! Anybody any users? All right, people not afraid to say it, that's good.
Yeah, we can admit it, it's okay.
Yeah,
this
is a safe room.
My favorite feature actually is the one we announced today around Microsoft Graph. I think the things it's going to light up for developers is amazing, and really the extent to which it's so easy to get going on it is really just kind of exciting, and the fact that we've been able to pull it together across all those teams.
Awesome. And Anders, you need no introduction, but introduce yourself.
I'm Anders Heilsberg. I'm a technical fellow in the developer division at Microsoft. And the first product I ever shipped was, well, probably the first one you'll know of was Turbo Pascal back in 1983. I actually shipped some products before that, like some Pascal compilers, you know, going all the way back to 1981. Favorite features, you know, well, now that we're...
Now you have to pick a favorite child between Pascal,
I know,
C-sharp,
it's really
and
hard.
TypeScript.
It's really hard. I, you know, I've enjoyed all the products I worked on. I think maybe one of the my most favorite aha moments was back in the really early days. Back then, you pretty much learned everything just by doing. And I had never learned about hash tables. And in the first Turbo Pascal 1.0, all simple table lookups were linear list scans, which obviously didn't scale so well.
Right.
And then I read this book that talked about hash tables. I'm like, really? Wow, that's amazing. I went and implemented, doubled the speed of the compiler. So
that's awesome.
That's how you learned back then. Yeah.
Oh, that's good old days. So, you know, this is an open time for you to ask questions. We have two runners, Dan and Dan. That's no joke. And I'm Dan, and Danny's in the back. So we have four Dans, which is not confusing at all. But it's really the time to ask any kind of questions you have, whether it's about Microsoft software development, how Verizon runs 50,000 containers in 72 seconds, really any sort of questions or even trends. I'd love to hear from you all. So get your questions ready. I'll kind of ask, you know, just want to start things off. Is what are the trends that you're seeing, that the differences in how software has been developed, even just the last couple of years? So, you know, you mentioned Docker containers and a number of other things. Be interesting to see the panel's approach on new software and what are the things that are changing as we build software. Anyone want to take that one? How's that?
I'll start off.
Sure.
So one of the things that we see in the web space is this notion of microservices, taking large applications and breaking them down into much, much smaller components, and then deploying those independently instead of as a huge monolithic application. So we're seeing that breakdown of applications. We've seen that happen over a couple of years. As people started building mobile applications, that was the API-ification of things, and now we're seeing the API-ification of APIs. And so that's something that we see. And also, obviously, in the web space, we see a lot more client code running in JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the areas that we want to go really drive with Visual Studio and even with the .NET stuff that we do, is making that transition of being able to write JavaScript code in the client that talks to some back-end code as seamless and easy as possible, and to flow validation and all that kind of stuff up and down through those paths.
Cool. Go ahead.
Well, I'll add, I think, well, it's pretty obvious here, but open source really is completely changing the developer landscape, at least from my vantage point.
Sure.
I think cross-platform as well, you know, the world has gone from being very homogenous to being very heterogeneous. JavaScript has seen a big resurgence, largely because of open source and cross-platform. So more, I feel like more has happened in the last two or three years than happened in the decade that went before it. It's really been quite transformative.
You know, the JavaScript one is interesting because you have a lot of folks and new libraries like React and so on that are taking logic, you know, maybe moving client logic that used to be in, say, a controller in an MVC world and moving it more to the client. So say with, say, React.js, and people are building kind of almost just a REST API instead of actually building, you know, HTML or doing client-side processing. Where do you see the fine line? It'd be kind of interesting as well to hear from the audience on what you all think about that. But what's the right line for people that are planning development in terms of logic primarily on the client versus server? And Larry, you're giggling, so I'll throw it to you.
Well, I think there's a couple things happening. The ability to on the edge, you actually have more processing power available, and in between, you have a fast network available. And I think that's actually causing some of this transition back to, I can actually truly run compute actually on the edge, and then you go into the server to get either your stateful data or do some of your heavy processing. So I think that you're seeing the shift. I think the same thing. You're seeing the microservices pop back up because people are now realizing it's sort of a back to the past. It's sort of like, hey, we need to decompose, build simpler things, and then piece them together in more complex ways. And you actually think back to how Unix did it with, you know, you used to pipe commands together. So you had very single tasked programs that you would put together. And we're kind of seeing that in microservices. So I think both the network's getting very fast, the edge component's getting very capable of doing processing. And then we can move our programming around.
I think a lot of them, that so much of it depends on the scenario. You know, I think Rob might have a lot to add, because recently we have been looking at, for example, how the Microsoft Office team builds all the different kind of mobile apps. And, you know, first of all, there's a tremendous amount of co-sharing for, you know, either the iOS or Android and the Windows version. So there's a lot of richness on the, you know, on the edge, on the client for sure. But at the same time, there's also a very important server component behind it. And there are some, you know, there are certain apps where most of the co-sharing, the functionality sharing actually happens on the back end. If you go to really small devices, like, you know, those things that that Scott Hanselman was demoing, when you go to IoT, then clearly there's very little power, you know, at the edge, where all of the computing power and the data processing, all of that has to happen on the server. So I think so much of it has to depend on what kind of experiences and app that you are building.
Yeah, I'll pile in on top of that. It is very much about the scenario, and the one dimension that I find critically important across a bunch of projects is actually around making sure you optimize for your developers' productivity. Because they will go figure out how to solve problems, and as long as you are convinced that A, they get to understand their problem space, and B, they can iterate quickly so that your engineering system really supports that, then you can make a lot of choices in the lines of how the architecture should run, but if make sure they're really performing in an optimal way, then you're going to be successful.
So I guess the question, there's so many applications that Office is putting out on iOS and Android. Like something like OneNote, you could think about maybe it'd be like a thin client, and most of the logic is on the server. I don't even know the architecture. How are you all dividing the line in terms of Office applications?
Well, actually, Julia had it exactly right. It depends on the application. There are some of them. Sway is one of the newest members of the Office family.
And for folks who don't know what Sway is?
Sway is all about interactive storytelling that looks beautiful and easy to create on the web, on a mobile device. And we see a lot of use in classrooms. We see a lot of use with people who want to have gorgeous output, but they don't necessarily have a design background. It really makes it easy to put that together. It's tons of fun to play with. Sway.com, check it out.
Okay.
That application is actually very much cloud intelligence driven. And the clients themselves are very lightweight communicating with that service. Applications like Excel are much more intensive in terms of taking advantage of the local client resources and then talking to the service as a repository for data in the case of Office 365. And there we found heavy investment around having shared code with a UI layer on top of that that we manage that runs across all the platforms where Excel lives. So it really does depend on the specifics of the scenario you're after.
So I was just talking to some folks, Joseph here from Xamarin, in terms of some of the different options that are available, and he's probably around here. What do you think, like, for a customer that has to choose, I want to target everything from a client perspective, iOS, Android, Windows, what should I choose, and what are the even criteria that I should be evaluating, you know, if this, then that, in terms of those options? Because a lot of people are asking, you know, is JavaScript the right answer? Is something like Xamarin the right answer? Or do I build native and pure experiences? And what are some of the, like you've mentioned, things are kind of dependent on the app that you should look for? And go for it.
Well, I mean,
JavaScript everywhere.
Well, no. I will certainly say that you can't make that decision without looking at JavaScript, because no doubt you're gonna write a web app, right? I mean, and there are so many options available today to run JavaScript on a server with Node.js and a number of mobile development toolkits like Ionic, Cordova, React Native, you know, that allows you to write the client tier as well. Or the mobile tier as well. So, you know, in terms of cross-platform, the only real game in town, or the big kahuna at least, is JavaScript. And a lot is being piled in on top of that, like TypeScript and development tools and frameworks and
the
what
ecosystem,
have you. So there's a very strong, there's a very strong ecosystem. Of all the package managers, NPM is growing by far the fastest. Yeah.
Right.
So I would look there. But sometimes you need to write a native app. I mean, if that's what you're going for, if you're going for best of breed on a particular device, you know, then ultimately that's probably what you need to look at. So it all depends. Yeah.
Let me jump in on that. I think that, you know, as Andrew said, you know, I think one of the key things about something like a JavaScript or like a Xamarin C# solution or a C++ solution is that you get a significant amount of co-sharing between, you know, iOS, Android, and the Windows platform. And it really, again, it comes to depend on the app. You know, we have all played with app, but a lot of the content are actually marketing content. like they have new things getting pushed. That's pretty HTML heavy. And for those things that, you know, like the updatability of your app and the ability to get new content is super important. So those apps are particularly well suited for JavaScript solution. And then you contrast that to something like Excel. And Excel actually, you know, actually we see this, we also see this trend that for a lot of these super large, large mobile apps, you know, the packages, I forgot how big is Excel on iOS, is a couple hundred megs.
They keep trying to make it smaller.
But I think that it really talks about the richness of the functionality at the edge. And then for these apps, you actually, you know, it's very common that you basically have 80, 90% of co-sharing primarily in C++. Because usually people have other platforms that they want to support. Then they have a very thin layer in either, you know, in Objective-C or in Java for the, you know, for the UI layer. That's actually how Office app is primarily built, and we also see that trend across some of the largest mobile apps. And I think that, you know, the Xamarin solution is also, you know, the Xamarin solution also very good. It gives you native experiences, and particularly if you have code you want to share that, you know, actually across C#. The other solution that we also have, you know, have a lot, getting a lot of adoption is the Cordova solution. And that is actually the HTML JavaScript. It's, you know, it is one UI. If you want the consistency of training, if you kind of, you know, working on the more the BYOD kind of scenarios for your employees, and you're not really looking for the exact best experience, the best experience on each device, you know, that is not the key criteria, where consistency is the criteria, because you don't want your support team to be telling your employee, which one do you have, and, you know, it works differently on the on iPhone versus iPad versus, you know, the different. Then I think that, you know, the Cordova is also a good solution. So I feel like we're saying it depends. It really depends what kind of app you're trying to build.
And, you know, think about it not just for iOS and Android, but, oh, there's a question over here. Great.
Yeah, just on those same lines, I have a question for Rob with respect to the Office ecosystem. Now that the Office apps are scaling to iOS and you're making a big, you know, splash there in that marketplace, what's the development lifecycle? So when you develop apps for Office, right, you know, you have obviously all the Office applications like Word, Office, or like Word, PowerPoint, Excel, and all, and you make those available in the iOS platform, what kind of development methodology do you follow? And what kind of release cadences do you have?
Do we follow around how we build and deploy those things?
Yeah.
Well, we're actually in the midst of a really interesting sea change for the business, where we're moving from the traditional package software world, where we give you a gigantic new release every 3 years, and then you'll hear from us 3 years later with another gigantic release. And with 2016, we actually very much announced an evergreen subscription model where people already get this on mobile, and they're used to it. They get updates every month with new features and new capabilities, with a bunch of bug fixes. We're actually working towards that model across all of the platforms. And so now organizations have the ability to get regular updates 3 times a year with new capabilities. Now that means we have to be really respectful of making sure we tell them what's coming on the roadmap. And it means we also have to offer flexibility that people can choose to defer or updates for a while if their organization isn't ready yet. And that's what we built into the model, so that we do have that evergreen life cycle is really where we're looking to go.
Great. Thanks for the question. You know, just a quick show of hands, how many people are actually building for iOS and Android today? Okay, and how about primarily for web? Is that everyone else? And both, I guess that's, okay, so you still find a number of people building both. And, you know, when I think about web development, one of the biggest pains is browser compatibility. And, you know, we're going through this now with our, as Julia knows, we're rebuilding MSDN, and one of the things we have to do is pick what is our minimum browser, and then figuring out all the test pain. And I just wondered, like, what are some of the things that you all are going through in terms of whether features or wish lists that you had to kind of remove the lowest common denominator of browser testing? Because it feels like that's a big pain. And actually, kind of show of hands, how bad is that pain? Couple, yes. I see some people raising 2 hands, so that's always a pain. Like, what could we do there, or what things are kind of in progress to make that easier?
Well, I'll start, since it sort of touches on some of what I'm working on right now. I think anyone writing a modern ECMAScript app today, or a JavaScript app, actually needs a link between, or something between the code they write and the code that runs. mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons. First of all, you want to be able to use modern features that are coming in ECMAScript 6, but you want to run on down-level browsers that don't yet have those features. You also want to be able to package up your app, you know, with other assets. You know, you want to use some module bundler or Webpack or something like that. So there's typically sort of the, as long as you can construct a development process where it's okay to have something in between, then there are actually tremendously good tools available today to abstract you, to get a unified view, modern ECMAScript with packaging and modules and whatever that allows you to write large apps, and you can even have static typing if you want with TypeScript, but some other people use Babel. You know, there are a variety of technologies that work that way. But I think that's really sort of the new reality, because if you look at how long it takes for these ECMAScript standards to make their way to the browser,
right.
even today, you can't really realistically assume that you have ECMAScript 5 compliance across the board. And mm-hmm. that standard is 6 years old now. You know,
right.
which so we basically have to sort of get used to the fact that there's a packager or transpiler or tool chain in between what you write and what you run.
Yeah, and I think that's always going to be a challenge there. And Julie, I don't know if you or Scott.
No,
has
I think
something
that
else.
Larry probably have a good yeah. thing to share.
I don't do a lot of web development, but what I find is it's the runtime you need that manipulates the DOM in the browser.
Yeah,
and then those become very, I mean, it's stuff you don't want to look at, because they have to handle all these different browsers.
Right.
And as a developer on top, you can sit and if you can choose one of those, but then you're locked into that. That almost becomes the platform that you've chosen. And if you look under the covers, it's scary. And it has to handle all the manipulation of a browser's little deficiencies. So it is a challenging problem, I think. And as a user of I see it a lot even inside our company that, you know, there's browser incompatibilities that you always come across, and it's very difficult.
Yeah, we've been shipping Bootstrap for many years for this exact mm-hmm. reason, because even as a seasoned web developer, it's hard. Even CSS is hard. I mean, there's a lot of hard stuff in web. Web is not simple. And so you start trying to do the browser stuff and the device different size stuff, all that stuff, you're going to find you're going to need some framework like a Bootstrap or something else to make that easier.
Everyone has shadow DOMs now.
Exactly. And you all your plugins to replace the features that don't exist, that like Anders was talking about. You know, a variety of issues, plugins to add features to older browsers so they actually can do newer stuff. So it's a combination of those plugins plus a library like Bootstrap, and then we're going to try to tool some of that as well. So I hope to add tooling around that to make that a better experience.
I think that the other thing I hear common from customers I talk to is that it's really the lack of information. You know, one of the things that, you know, as companies are evaluating whether they want to roll out, you know, Windows 10, et cetera, they don't know how many of their internal websites do have the dependency on IE6. And how many users actually hitting it. There's just a lack of information. They simply didn't know. I think that I know, for example, Windows team actually wrote out a little program where, you know, they help you deploy a little server that helps you, you know, kind of figure out, oh, here's a ping from this URL that I actually really truly need an IE6 feature. And I think that a lot of this is just because of the lack of information, then you have the fear that you don't want to turn it off in case something important doesn't, you know, stop working. So I think that, you know, a lot of things about IT management, we also wonder about how can we get more information so people can make a more data-driven and more, you know, a more informed decision.
Well, that's even tougher now, because a lot of the modern frameworks like Angular and Bootstrap and stuff like that, they only go back a certain number of browser versions.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
IE6
right.
is not supported by those. You're going to have
right.
to build something different if
right.
you're going to go that far back.
And that's why a lot of corporate have two browsers. They have a standard browser, and then they have another one that people use. How many of you have that?
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of anybody still have ActiveX controls? We got a question on that. Anybody? Do there's a couple. Yeah. See, it's okay. This is a safe room.
Serial
COM control.
Oh my. Yeah.
It actually was probably really easy to write at one point, and now nobody has the source control for it. And but these are some of the real challenges, especially when upgrading. I'm assuming that's in an enterprise app.
Yeah.
Could we get a mic on? I'd love to just hear a little bit more about the actual app.
Here we go. So it's actually a barcode printing application.
Okay.
So rather than deploying a thick application around the world, because it would take a long time to upgrade and process those machines, literally hundreds of machines around the corporation, I actually decided to write an application that would be web-based, and it uses the serial COM controller to talk to the Zebra barcode printer, which back then was just serial.
Mm-hmm.
And today you could do it via internet, but it's legacy code and nobody's touched it for a long time.
So are you planning to upgrade it? What is the future of this ActiveX controller, this incredibly popular and now probably production,
my
you know, mission
retire.
Critical?
Plan is to make it someone else's problem.
Yeah. Well done. Well done. I do not. I was going to give you my resume. Now I know. Question back over here. One of the Dans.
I have a question for Larry on Verizon. You guys have a lot of public information, right? A lot, right? You store phone numbers, records, CDRs of several different people around the world. Yep. So when you decided to go to the cloud, right, what kind of privacy concerns did you have, and how did you go about mitigating some of those?
Yeah, we're under tremendous rules within the company on how we handle, especially customer data, as any company probably is, but probably more so Verizon and a lot of telecom companies. A lot of our data is internal, and so that's one way, is that you just keep it internal. We have strict controls on how you store, how you encrypt it, how you transport it in an encrypted channel. There's lots of procedures and processes we have to go through to handle that data. So it's and some of it's not even available to all the applications, as you probably should be happy about that. So it's very hard, it's very difficult. We have to be really careful, make sure developer machines don't ever pull that customer data down. So then we have to create, you know, test data that would mimic the real data, because you don't want to be moving the customer data around. And a lot of times we don't put stuff on public cloud because of these constraints we're under. And so those are all kept internal.
Yeah, we actually have a very similar set of stories in Office 365, and so it is this exact experience of, bug comes in from the service, developer is going to debug that from logs and other telemetry and hooks that we built in, because they're not allowed to touch the customer data, even to debug that customer's problem. If they turn out to need that, 90% of the time we've gotten to the point where they don't need that level of access, but then if they do, then we actually have to go get permission from the customer and have somebody watch the developer as they do it, because that's the level of security and privacy we have to respect. Yep.
So, and this actually is a good segue to thinking about the cloud. So, you know, how many of you are actually deployed, have something live in the cloud today? So if you see, it's, you know, not that many, maybe a third of the room, maybe a little less than half. So, and I'd love to hear some of the reasons why you're not deploying, whether it's privacy or security or some of those things. But to me, I think it's kind of interesting. This panel is about the future of software development. A lot of folks are just moving an app from on-prem to cloud. Is that it, or what are the dream scenarios that the cloud lets us do that we haven't even maybe thought of? And it'd be kind of interesting to hear from the panel on the dream cloud future. Anyone want to put themselves on the?
Well, I think that, you know, I will just jump in and say a couple of things. I will say that, you know, like I always, you know, we're seeing great success with Office 365, the adoption around Exchange and SharePoint and all the tools. And I will say Exchange is actually a very great SaaS story. You always wondered why you want, you know, IT operators worldwide to operate the Exchange server, where the most knowledgeable people of operating it is actually in Microsoft, who can actually debug it. That's not something that when there's issue arise. And that is just, you know, I think that we're seeing the movement of going to SaaS, where if, you know, for things like this, if I don't have to go hire IT person to operate, to learn about Microsoft Exchange, you know, to take on the burden of updating and upgrading, that should be Microsoft the problem. That shouldn't be, you know, this particular company's problem. I think we're beginning to fulfill some of those dreams, is that is not really, if you're a financial company, you're a manufacturer company, that is not your core competency. You should not be spending time worrying about it. So I think that's one thing. And I think that cloud offers tremendous promise in scale and in what you can do with that scale. So we're seeing, you know, one of the things we're seeing is tremendous interest in data, in big data. And these are not, you know, like, these are not things you can hold on on-prems, you know, any kind of relational database servers. When you have petabytes and, you know, and terabytes of data that's going through that you have to go process and understand in real time and really get business value out of it. And then the corresponding kind of machine learning you have out of it. I think that is actually more where I think cloud will start really fulfilling and creating tremendous new values. You know, in the future, I was sitting in a partner meeting last night, talking to some of the, you know, a couple of folks happen to be in the insurance company, in the insurance business. And, you know, just the sort of the IoT married with the data where, you know, like as a insurance company, if you understand, you know, your customer's health situation, understand their, you know, their sort of health habit. You know, if you have a, think about if you have a band, you understand how often they actually exercise. You understand their driving habit. That will actually be transformative in terms of how you think about your insurance business. And these are the things that of the future, which is very near. It's not as far as we think. And I think these are actually what cloud enables. It's really business transformations that is just not kind of available today, particularly when we talk about big data. In the past, even 10 years ago, the amount of computing resources that you actually need are only held in the data centers of the few companies. And now that become really democratized, that become available to any companies, a lot of startups to take advantage of. So I think that is actually going to be very, very powerful.
I'm a big fan of PaaS. Yeah. So as somebody, I actually did this recently internally. We had a application that we moved from a third-party cloud to the Azure cloud. And we just did the lift and shift. We didn't modify the application at all. We just moved it.
Right.
Now, the reality of doing that is I still have to have IT, meaning that I have to have somebody that goes and checks the health of that machine, somebody that watches that machine every day to make sure it stays up and reboot it or whatever it needs to keep going. And we're in the process right now of moving that same application into a PaaS platform, which is platform as a service. And what platform as a service means for me is I don't have to ever worry about, hey, there's a new class of Intel chips out, and I want to upgrade to use those. I get that for free. There's a new version of the operating system out, and I might want to use those capabilities. I don't have to wait for my enterprise to go and decide to adopt a new OS. I get that for free. All the things like monitoring and stuff like that are built into the platform. And if I want, if I have a problem, I actually have a phone number I can call and get support. So it's a supported platform. And so if you just think of it, the amount of people that we have just working to keep stuff running, that will decrease hugely as you move to a PaaS platform. You lose a little bit of capability as part of that, but you gain so much extra functionality. You know, inside of Azure, our PaaS platform, which is Azure Websites, provides backup capabilities, it provides the auto-scaling capabilities that Julia was talking about, it provides the ability to live test new parts of your application piece by piece. It has staging and production. Those are all things that your IT group would normally build for you, and they're just features of the platform. And so I think if people haven't looked at that, you should really look at that, because it's transformative.
I think people sometimes think that you lose some flexibility, but what you're really doing is, like, I like to say, you're delivering the nuts and bolts that people need. It's like, how many times do I need to implement logging? How many times do I need to implement monitoring? So all this stuff, and this is what we did internally. We went to a cluster-based system, so look at the data center as a cluster and deploy your applications onto it. And to bring it back to developers, I think it's changing how we develop. The microservices is now we're breaking things into smaller components. The data processing we're having, now we're exploding the number of operating components in an application, which goes back to how do you debug such things? And you can't really have a developer log into a machine and say, right. Oh, let me go poke around the machine, because that machine might be running many different things at one time. And if my app's truly distributed, I can't just stop one component and sit there and ponder what's going on when everything else starts depending on it and you start having timeouts. And so I think the way we develop, the way we deploy, the way we debug in this type of environment has to change. And you're starting to see some of the tools catch up.
Yep.
But you're seeing some of the developers aren't catching up. Some of it's very difficult.
I want to drill into there. So you mentioned a great example. Like, you can imagine a microservice world. There's multiple services. Those could each be on different hosts. And like thinking about a Verizon example, how do you do that tracing and have the information to know how the services, like, it'd be interesting to hear how you all are doing it today.
Yeah, so one is, as you know, we use Mesos to launch our clusters, and that keeps track of all these tasks. So if I take an application, it's broken into N number of tasks dispatched by Mesos, but everything is logged, and you can monitor, and you can actually piece back to where something is at a moment in time on what node, mm-hmm. and you can collect the environmental information. And we're not as sophisticated as where I like to go, because what you want to piece together is it's almost like a puzzle or forensic exercise.
Right.
Is I know at some moment in time there is a failure. I know I can trace back that task to a specific node, and therefore I can get all the environmental issues that went on that node. So I might start seeing, maybe statistically, I start seeing, hey, this node's having a problem. It's acting abnormal. Every time this application landed on this node, there's some abnormal behavior. Maybe there's a hardware fault going on, and you can start looking into these things. So
right.
Part of it is the ability to take all the monitoring data and analyze it and piece it all back together so that you can actually see what's going on at any moment in time. And a lot of the information's there, just sort of getting it all together.
And how many people here are looking at or evaluating Docker specifically? Okay, just a couple of hands, not that many. But it'd be interesting, panel, what is Docker? Is it the future, the entire world will be Dockerized? Or how do you all see this? I think Larry says yes.
Yeah, well, we run Linux inside, sorry. I look at it more as the container technology, and containers have actually been around for quite some time. Docker sort of made it cool,
right?
Which they did a great job on that. But the idea and why we latched onto is the idea of containers is if I'm going to start breaking my applications into these components, and my container can become what I referred as the unit of execution, and I can move that around the different machines that can carry its environment, and then I have reasonable separation on that one node. So the container itself is giving that application a view of its own environment, and I think that's incredible. The abstraction there is what's empowering, I think, for our applications. So I think that concept, I think containers will evolve. I think they'll start taking advantage of some of the hardware features you see in VMs. You guys are part of it. We're standardizing the container image
right.
formats. I think that's going to be a big help. But I think the concept is here to stay.
I just think of how long does it take somebody to build a VM today? And then after you build a VM, how long does it take to boot the VM? And how long does it take you to distribute the VM to 50 machines?
Yep.
How many containers are you talking about booting up and how long?
Yeah, 50,000, 72 seconds.
That is it to me. I mean, VMs are an awesome concept, but today they're very heavy. They're expensive to build. They're large size. They're hard to distribute. And the container world solves those problems.
Yeah, I agree.
Great. I see no objections on the. I thought for sure. So let me start something controversial then. How many people here have heard of the 10x engineer? The 10x engineer. It's a theory. Oh, there's even a question. I'll wait on my 10x engineer.
I think he's one of them. Actually.
Yeah.
So IoT and variables. How do they fit into the future of software development?
IoT and variables?
Variables.
Oh, variables. Do you guys?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of IoT and variables. I truly believe that, I think we're only in the very beginning of the IoT revolution. I think it's going to be the next, I do believe it's one of the next big waves that's coming in computing. And partly because it has to do with how inexpensive these things are getting. It has to do with the cloud that's now available for all of these things to pipe signals to, or either directly or through a gateway. And then with the cloud, you have more or less infinite storage. You have a lot of usage for these things that just the infrastructure wasn't there before. I have seen, startups working on very interesting things, including, wearables in your wearables in your shirt,
in the fabric.
So I think we're only scratching the surface of the possibilities.
Yeah, I think the economies are finally getting there. Both on the end device.
Yeah.
We said earlier the chips
edges.
Are underpowered, but they're really not. I mean, you look at some of these; they're 32-bit processors running on some
of
these. It's like back when you were writing Pascal compilers,
you can get
right?
Today for like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that
pennies on the dollar, you can get computers that are more powerful.
The very small edge is powerful. We have communication. We have the ability to get that data into the cloud. So the little embedded device by itself is not as interesting. The ability to network it all, get the
That's
data
right.
back
yep.
into a place where you can
That's
process
right.
it.
That's where it's cool.
Yeah.
Is tremendous, and the economies are all falling into place.
Yeah, I feel like the infrastructure has finally fallen into place to truly make a play on it. Without the popularity of the cloud and kind of the coverage and the gateway devices and all, without those things, then you have individual devices. They can send signal and they don't really go anywhere. But now, though, I think the back end infrastructure has fallen into place.
You know, we're seeing a lot of folks talk about the self-driving cars, whether it's Tesla or Google, and you start thinking about these things that actually become more like mesh networks. For me, it's obviously interesting if you all have kids, that, you know, whether it's my, you know, my son or, you know, his son, when should he choose to have children, may never drive, right? The entire concept of driving will be like, I can't believe you all are doing this. But you need so in terms of next feature, mesh networks, how do you get these things? If we think about all of these, whether it's cars or something else, you need a way to be able to program about that. How do you all think about how programming languages or things to program, things we haven't thought of before, where we're getting so many of these different inputs and then making almost the right decision? And some of that hits machine learning as well. But I'd love to kind of hear more of the future far out thoughts there.
Well, from programming languages, I don't think solutions to these problems are likely going to be in the programming language. But what you're going to see in programming languages is more abstraction models that are more useful, like, for example, asynchronous programming, you know, and the ability to divvy workflows into little pieces that execute, but you can keep the state around, you know, so it feels to you like a super lightweight thread, you know, and you can then start reasoning about isolation and concurrency and so forth. So that's sort of where programming languages will help, is really introducing more the correct programming idioms and like the correct guidance around whether you should be single-threaded here or multi-threaded, whether you should use functional style.
Do you think it's more the frameworks that would then come up and say, hey, that's how I work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the cloud, you know, I mean, a lot of this data is going to go into the cloud, and then you're going to reason about it. You're going to reason about it probably with machine learning toolkits, for example, you know, that, which again comes back to the past thing we were talking about earlier, you know, that I think it's sort of, the days are gone where you can fight past. You have to accept the fact. No, but it's really kind of like fight. It's just rewind 25 years, it'd be like fighting the resurgence of frameworks, right? No, I'm going to write everything from scratch every time. That's how I like to do it, because I know what's in there then, right? But
sure.
But you can't do that. You gotta leverage what's already there, and the way you leverage in the cloud is through PaaS, I think.
We're talking about Back to the Future. One of the things that Scott Hanselman showed was .NET Framework code targeting native, where it's doing native compilation. And if you all remember, .NET Framework was everything about JIT compilation. So are we coming back full circle and saying native is the way to go? Or how do you all think about native versus JIT? Because that was always an interesting thing where people would debate one way versus the other.
I think it depends on where you run the code. Again, it's that there's no one answer. You know, on a mobile device, if you're going to deliver the app to 2 million devices and then have 2 million devices burn battery to turn that into native code, that doesn't seem like smart if you could compile it once and then deliver the native code, right?
Okay. Yep.
But in certain cloud scenarios that are very dynamic, where code, in a sense, adapts itself, you know, like, I mean, you look at frameworks, like most web frameworks, you don't actually pre-compile the whole code. You have templates and whatever, and then the app dynamically builds itself, and you like to have that cycle where you just, like, modify a page and save it. And that page may have code in it, and that code may need to be recompiled, but you don't want to rebuild the entire image of your corporate website. You know, you can't do that. So it's got to be broken down into little pieces, and this is where VMs and jitters make a lot of sense. So it all depends.
Yeah. Actually, let me give you a concrete example. We were just working on this issue with our Bing team 6 months ago. So, you know, as you guys imagine, Bing has, you know, massive number of machines in their data center, and, you know, one of their core servers is actually written in .NET. And so they come contact us because they're on the rapid, you know, DevOps kind of cycle that they're actually deploying, like, every other day or something. They're like, hey, guys, like, you know, C# is great, I love it, but I'm all of my, you know, every time I deploy, my server is spending, you know, like 20 minutes jitting this massive thing all the time across, you know, you multiply by hundreds and thousands of machines. Like, they're like, you can literally multiply and get a dollar figure out of the time spending jitting, like, every other day over all of these machines.
There's an app for that.
Yeah, and then so we kind of, we're like, yeah, that doesn't seem to make sense. So we actually work out a great solution where they can actually do a lab compile, and you know, for them, and all of these machines are more or less exactly the same. That, you know, like 95% of the code is actually, you know, become native, and then the machine only had the JIT, like the 5% a little bit. And so that become, you know, like literally in terms of dollar savings, that's just a tremendous, right? So like that's a great example where you have a single instance of a corporate website, it doesn't make sense to go pre-compile it.
Exactly.
But when you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of the same image that's lying around in your data center, and then the equation changes dramatically.
We have a prototype of ASP.NET that runs with .NET Native. And we didn't see any performance improvements in the site, other than probably, yeah, there was some jitting and stuff that wouldn't happen, so that maybe the startup time was a little faster. The big thing we saw was a reduction in working set. But as Julia said, if you're building a corporate website, neither of those things matter. So I think it just depends on this, on what you're doing.
Yeah, and then if you're actually going to a smaller device, you don't want your phone to be sitting there jitting. Or if it's, you know, something that's less powerful, right?
Yep. But just adding one thing, which is, you know, ultimately, when you run your code today, almost no matter what platform you're or VM you're running it in, you're running native code. It's just a matter of how you got the native
code.
Right. You could either compile it ahead of time, or you could compile it right before you need it. But like any self-respecting JavaScript VM today, or .NET or Java, they all JIT to native code and then run the native code. So
that's why native didn't make the ASP.NET application any faster at all.
Yes, exactly.
It already is native.
Yeah, yeah. The days of classic interpreters are pretty much over. Yeah.
And I think another big topic when you think about applications moving is DevOps. And, you know, for a lot of folks, they're trying to understand and get a level of maturity, like just deploying an application today or even having the telemetry to know this is where the problem is in the app. It's really sort of immature. And how do you all see this going? And in particular, you know, for Larry, how you all do it and how Microsoft is using DevOps to kind of improve not just the information instrumentation, but how we actually are improving the development cycle.
Let Larry go first.
I'll go first, yeah.
They love putting you on the spot.
Well, so we're, you know, we're just getting into the Verizon, you're looking at this, moving to this DevOps model, because traditionally we did things in a very traditional manner, how we operated our systems, and it was very slow to introduce changes. And so, yes, we are adopting a DevOps model, and that puts a lot of pressure on the org, because it changes how you test things. It changes the processes, who does what when. And if you really want to, and we all think it's important to get there, because one is we want to deliver features, but we also want to fix problems just as fast. But this does put a tremendous amount of change in the organization. Your tool set has to be very capable, because now you want to be able to go from that development time, you want to be very confident in your testing ability, that you can automate all your tests, you can automate the whole compile, deploy, test, if it auto promotion, right? So, hey, it passed my test, because what do we do now? We run a bunch of tests, and then we sit and look at the results and go, okay, it passed, we should launch. Well, what other decision were you going to make? if you ran all the tests that you can conceive of, would you launch? Well, probably, and if we can get comfortable with being able to launch and then detect anomalies in as you launch. So one is you start moving load, right? You start partially, and again, we get in distributed systems, I can do this. I can slow roll and update. So I can replace parts of my application, and then I can monitor that application. And if I start seeing anomalies, I can even roll back. Mm-hmm. And but all these have to all be integrated into the tool sets. I'm sure you guys are all thinking about how to do this, because this is, again, this is, goes back to, it's not the simple, I sit in my PC and I compile, debug, you know, run, and now I have to deploy, and I'm getting real-time feedback on live data potentially, and I need to detect that and roll it.
Totally agree. I think that, you know, as I spend time talking to customers, really, you know, a few things really come across. One is that, you know, when I see a company that really feel the urgency of transformation and change for whatever business reasons, then they're very eager to have a top-down decision to drive this kind of DevOps changes. And, you know, as exactly as Larry said, this kind of needs to go a bit of top-down. This is less about, you know, bottom-up, you know, enablement. And I think that a lot of team is already pretty familiar with Agile. And then the DevOps concept, to me, I think there's two key kind of things that I continuously ask myself all the time. One is continuous deployment. Are you actually continuous deploying? Because, you know, the team can say, hey, the dev team can say, hey, I'm doing really fast and I'm doing automated tests. But until you deploy, you don't really know whether you actually hit the quality level that really needs to be achieved. And then sometimes we have also seen that team that running really fast are building up a test debt because they're actually not deploying. And then the second part of it, once you start doing continuous deployment, then the key thing is, you talk about monitoring, you know, it's really about getting the telemetry, getting the feedback out of that system, which is a combination of what I think about as both technical insight and customer insight. So technical insight is that, is the system up? How's the performance? How, you know, is it actually hitting the sort of the SLA that I have? And how do I fix it very quickly? Those are what I think about as technical insight. Then there's a sort of the customer behavior kind of analysis that needs to come through from that system as well, is that you deployed it to achieve some business goals. Well, did they actually achieve the business goals? And if you hadn't achieved business goals, then how does that change, you know, your backlog the next time around? So it, the, you know, the system from production had to go give you two streams of information on both technical side and business side. And actually getting that loop, that closed loop coming, that be able to act on those information very quickly, then do the development and then the deployment again. That really, now you really get into the magic of the DevOps, of that rapid iteration, rapid learning and cycle.
I think if you get into the, if you're confident in your ability to deploy, which means you can roll back.
That's right.
And if you get confident in that ability, it lets you put something out there, you detect the change, you know you can rapidly fit. I always say, like, if I want to make sure I can get out of trouble,
but
I know I'm going to get into trouble.
That's right.
So we got to be able to get ourselves back out.
That's right. Yeah. It's that. It's really, we think about the meantime to mitigation, right? How quickly can mitigate it? Yeah.
I think you brought up good points as well about frameworks too. I mean, we need to change frameworks. Frameworks need to support these models. I mean, you brought up a great point earlier that if you're doing microservices and you blast them into a cloud, you just can't put a breakpoint there. Because if it stops, the whole thing stops. So it means that we need to be able to turn things like logging on and off on the fly. We need to be able to turn the level of logging on and off on the fly. Maybe the frameworks can be modified to actually tell you that you're doing too many network calls, or your network calls are taking X long, to give you the metrics and the monitoring you need to actually diagnose these things without doing it the traditional way that we've done it, with a guy sitting behind a profiler or a debugger.
Yeah, exactly.
The two things I love them, I totally agree with them, about speed of deployment and iteration, and then insight and intelligence about what's going on with the system that runs. We absolutely see all of that. The thing we're now trying to embrace and really get to is this notion of sharing with our developers what we see going on as they call Office 365. And so working with them to make sure that they get a heads up about roles that are coming and a place to evaluate in the sandbox and telemetry and data about their solutions calling Office 365, because it becomes more than just us operating our solution, it's actually us operating our solution in conjunction with our partners, who are both independent ISVs and very much corporate IT developers. So it really does become this shared cloud ecosystem.
Yeah, I think one of the, just, you know, when Julia was talking about using data points, just a funny one. In Visual Studio, everybody familiar with add reference? There's another option that says add service reference. And we saw a lot of people clicking add service reference. And if you look at that, you may say, like, wow, maybe a lot of people are using Windows Communication Foundation. What we actually looked is the data. The next most common thing is somebody clicking cancel, meaning they clicked and they, you know, accidentally hit the wrong thing. And, you know, within a second, they click cancel. So it just leads to the importance of making sure that you actually have the right telemetry and even the paths, whether it's server-side software or client-side software, that you really understand how your customers are using software. And I always thought that was a really funny data point. You know, we were talking about, I'll mention my 10X engineer question, is talk about some of the human part, because a lot of software development is humans, and one of the challenges is even hiring. And, you know, just the amount of people that we're going to need in the software development industry in 5 to 10 years, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics says we're going to basically need to double the number of software developers in the U.S. in 10 years. So it's just a huge amount of people that we have to have. And there was one specifically about a 10X engineer. And there was a quote by, and I'll do it, Sam Bagot said, a 10X engineer is a developer who incurs technical debt so fast that he or she appears more productive than the 10 developers tasked with cleaning their mess up. So I thought that was really funny, because it leads to, sometimes we've seen kind of that 10X engineer, and I think you're 100X, Anders, I'm not pulling, but how do you think about software and hiring, and especially there's such a crazy demand where almost anybody can jump to any company and salaries are increasing. That seems to be not just the technical part, but more the, how do I keep my employees happy? And what do you see in sort of the human trends there?
One of the things that I find very liberating about open source is the fact that it's open source and it's all out there. And now when I interview people, some of them will have a history on GitHub, for example, and you can go look, well, what did you contribute to? What did that code look like?
Right, right.
What kind of questions did you answer or ask?
What was your attitude?
And, oh, well, that too, but yeah. I mean, but I think that is a remarkable tool.
Sure.
I think, because there's no hiding that there. And I mean, I've done so many interviews where, you know, you have to try to figure it out in an hour, and it's just not possible.
Right.
You know, and I see a lot of companies now go, hey, just, you have a week, just here's a question or a problem, go code it up, put your solution on GitHub, and we'll talk to you in a week, and we'll see what you came up with.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you know, I think that makes a ton of sense, because a lot of people don't think like that, and sometimes you don't want the guys who have a fast answer for everything, or the girls who have a fast answer
right.
for everything. You want a deep thinker, and deep thinkers don't think it through in an hour.
Yeah.
You know, so I find that very liberating.
Cool. Anything else on hiring?
Absolutely, using GitHub as a portfolio, just like a designer would have a design portfolio. I love that philosophy. And also more and more getting into away from, oh, let's quick mock up the problem on a whiteboard. Let's actually sit down and do paired programming in front of a console, and let's build something that actually runs. But at the end of the day, you're looking for people who are going, because if you listen to all the things we talked about, it was this, I'm going to go learn from data, and I'm going to change the way that I work. And 6 months from now, it'll be totally different, because will have evolved. So that really speaks to a passion for listening and a passion for learning about what's really going on in the world.
Yeah, and that brings us, you know, we're just have a couple of more minutes here. So I have just fun history lesson. Visual Studio 2010 launched a number of years ago, and I looked at the blog announcement, and some of the key features were Silverlight support, Windows Communication Foundation, Windows Workflow, and a series of tools for Architecture Explorer. So kind of that was 5 years ago in terms of some of the differences. Where do you all see future software development 5 years? We're going to be in this room. I'm sure I'll have more gray hair. Where do you all see things going in 5 years? And just kind of ask the panel, we'll maybe go that way, since we started putting Julie on the spot first. So.
Well, that's tough to answer quickly. I think, you know, for me, it's development environments. What do development environments look like in 10 years? And I think we're sort of seeing a gradual breakdown of the monolithic IDE into more discrete pieces where you can pick from open source best of breed pieces for what it is you're going to build. I'm going to pick my favorite editor with my favorite build tool, with my favorite unit testing framework, with my favorite UI framework, and put it all together, you know, using command line and, you know, your directory structure is your project system, your windowing system is your desktop is your windowing system. You know, that's sort of where it's going.
Shut up and take my money, honestly.
Right.
That's good enough for me. That's great.
So clearly the rate of change is going to keep increasing. The expectations will keep going up. And so it will, in fact, be mind-blowing about whatever it's going to be. It'll be crazy. The thing that I will say is more and more I'm excited about openness and open source and really this sensation that we as an industry are working together to build something together that really makes life better for customers. So.
That's good.
So I think a lot of the stuff we talked about with distributed computing, a lot of microservices, things being decomposed into parts, things being loosely coupled, you know, that you talk about mesh. I think the tools got to keep up, so the tools got to, one, figure out. We got to change how we debug these systems. We got to change how we observe. We talked about information. So all this telemetry coming back, we're going to need tools that are going to help us comprehend all that information and then turn that back into a productivity tool for the developer.
Great.
Mine's just a spin on what Andrew said. I think that, you know, the days of being a C# developer only or a C++ developer only, those days are going to go away. The reality is, as we move forward, you're going to have to know a variety of technologies, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, maybe some server language or JavaScript on the server. But I think it's even IDEs are going to have to change in the way that they present stuff to people because you're interoperating with different technologies and they need to mesh together well. And that's I think, one of the challenges we're going to see in the next 4 or 5 years.
Great.
Well, since I work on Visual Studio 2010, I'm like, clearly we're terrible at predicting the future. And this is actually why we stopped doing 5-year plans, because we're terrible at predicting the future. But let me try to predict.
It'll be Visual Studio 2020.
Ah.
That's what you're doing.
So, So I think that one of the area, you know, actually, you know, with Larry, I really agree is that I think we're going to see a lot more telemetry data, you know, the big data space really grow significantly. And just from us spending a little bit of time in that space, it looks, you know, I think that is a very young space. It's very immature. I think the experience today, you know, my developer said, this is like going back to the stone ages. I'm like, yeah, I know. So I definitely think that, you know, as the, you know, we talk about the IoT trend, et cetera, you know, as more data is actually showing up, I think that the ability to develop against data, the ability to know whether you're actually putting the right data collection point even in your product, and whether you're processing it fast enough, or actually whether you're getting the insights out of it. Actually, how do you do A/B testing? You know, like that's something that's reserved for the elite today, and become a, you know, a common tool that anyone can use. And really, truly, you know, understand to be able to adjust user behaviors based on your A/B testing that eventually feedback your product. These are new things that very, very few people can do it well today. And I think that's something that's going to become more common in the next 5 years. And I think that, you know, more tools and exceptional framework time, you know, runtime and all of those things will be needed to kind of advance that particular science.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for staying. Just a reminder, on the back of your card is directions to the party. It is free drinks, free food. And a big thank you to my panel. Thank you so much. You guys have been great. Thank you all for coming.